Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. Today we're having a very special kitchen table broadcast with author and longtime friend of the podcast, Ella Risbridger, on her new anthology of poetry, Set Me On Fire, A Poem for Every Feeling. Hi, Ella.
Hi, Pal.
Hi. As everyone can hear, again, kitchen table broadcast, which means we get to have Sylv walking around the place.
She just wants to be involved.
It's always, she'll be perfectly quiet for like an hour, sitting in a little, you know, little circle by herself, and then just sounds all the time as soon as the microphone goes on. But Ella, I get like a email probably every day from a publicist who is asking me to break the format of this podcast for their client. It's like, hi, I know you're all about just, you know, other people's books, but my client would like to come on and talk about her book. And I'm like, go fuck yourself, publicist. Listen to the damn podcast. However, I am breaking format today for a very special reason, which is that this book is dedicated to me.
I was going to say, those publicists are really missing a trick.
Yeah, what you get is you get the author to dedicate it to me, and then, you get what you want.
You spend nearly a decade formulating a careful and deep bond forever.
Yeah.
And after that, it's easy.
So get your author to come over, and then in 10 years, you can be in the podcast.
Perfect, yeah.
Guys, I'm going to lock up the dog. I'm going to put the dog in another room and see how that does, okay?
Why is she doing this? Okay. Third time lucky,
and we're back. So as we mentioned a minute ago, before the dog got involved, this book is dedicated to not only, but me.
So, I think it's dedicated to you, as I say, for, apart from the obvious reason, that you're my dear friend and I love you very much, for two reasons. It's sort of dedicated to you as a stand-in for all the people who hate a thing that their best friend loves, and all the people who love a thing that their best friend hates. And this is the one essential tension in their relationship.
Yeah.
Because I think everyone's been there, right? Is that you're like, I love this. I love the art. I love the films of a director. I don't know any directors. I don't know anything about anything except poetry and also snacks.
It is that thing of like, I love you so much. We're so simpatico on so many different things in our life.
Simpatico.
For some reason, I've been using it a lot more lately. I think I've just been reading a lot of like 80s and literature.
It's because you read Riders.
I think it's because I read Riders, yeah. And simpatico is a word you'd find in there. We're so if you're so aligned with one person on so many different things, down to a spooky level, and then just like this one thing where you're like, nope, don't do it, can't have it, won't have it. And for me, I think that was also me being like 22 and also wanting to annoy you. Being like, it's all bollocks, I hate it all. So it was partly, here's to how to irritate my best friend. And it was partly, and I think I shared this with a lot of people who came to poetry late or never come to it at all, which is that I associated too much with academic failure. And I think that's the main thing with people, right?
Yeah, because, I think so.
And yeah, and that's a lot to do with how poetry is taught, but it also has a lot to do with memory. And for me, like, I've now sort of come to the conclusion that, like, oh, I wasn't like a dumb kid. My memory doesn't work in that I can't just memorize things that people tell me to memorize. Like, everything in my brain will just be like, nope. And for me, poetry was one of those things that people would just ask you to memorize and never give you a good reason to do it. And I would always fail at that. And it would always be this thing of like, well, I love language. I love stories. I love writing. I love English class. But then poetry comes up and just this cloud is like, oh, they're going to ask me to memorize a load of crap.
I mean, I also hated poetry in school. There are poems I know are good. I know they must be good. Because I can see that with my, like, kind of my intellectual mind, I'm like, I can see this is a good poem. And I just remember sitting in an English lesson thinking, they're going to make me underline all the similes.
Yes.
They're going to make me write out what a simile is, and I don't care.
Yes. And that's it. It becomes this sort of like, poetry in English becomes, in English classes rather, it becomes like a sandbox for things we do in the English language. Symbols, metaphors, similes, like it becomes really, what's the word for it? Formulaic, I suppose.
Yes, yes. And it's taught in such a way, I think, partly because of the poems we choose. I think, I don't want to tread on the toes of anyone in the national curriculum, but certainly the national curriculum, as I remember it, was full of poems that I felt even as a child were extremely patronising. Poems written for children to demonstrate what a simile was, etc. You know those kind of poems?
Yeah.
And I could always feel like, you've written this poem so that we will be able to write similar poems in class.
Oh, very bad,
and they would all go on a wall. Ah, your poem's about a caterpillar. We're all going to have to write them about different bugs now, I bet. And that will be a tedious 2 hours. And then it will be playtime and we will be allowed out.
Yeah.
And at secondary school, I just hated it. I always hated being taught about poetry. Mm. And I guess it's one reason that I'm glad it's me doing this book and not maybe someone who loved English at school and loved, I guess, that academic approach to literature.
Yeah.
Which
like
I don't
choosing a
really...
poem like a gymkhana, basically, where you're like, if you jump all these things, then you get the rosette at the end, as opposed to appreciating it as a piece of language.
Yes, and I have very little interest in poem as gymkhana.
Yeah.
Oh, what a great little metaphor.
Again, writers. A metaphor.
A metaphor is when you say a thing is like another thing, and a simile is a form of metaphor. It makes me want to die.
Sure. But then, slowly, over the course of our friendship, you started, like, seeding to me, like, just sending me links to things and being like, this is, maybe you like this, and, like, tweeting things. And it was almost always, like, quite funny, quite acerbic, quite strange, generally by women, generally written in the last sort of 30 or 40 years, which, again, was not kind of poetry that I would come up against, do you know what I mean? Generally, yeah. You think poem, you think Sylvia Plath or before. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like the newest poem in the world is by Sylvia Plath, is how you think growing up, right?
Yes. And she's a woman and she's dead. And she actually killed herself because of being a woman. So I think you should get a clue because that's what women write about. They write about being dead.
They don't write about jokes or relationships or friendship or
telly.
Eating or, you know what I mean? I think you have single-handedly taught me the sort of the fun and wit and like pleasure of poetry, and I'm really excited for you to do that for other people too.
I hope so. It feels like quite a big task at this point. Yeah. Can I teach the world to sing? But I will try. I will try, mostly because I love it so much. It is such an endless source of, without wanting to sound like a born-again Christian, a joy and comfort in my life, and I really hope that together we can give you that too. There's no way of talking about this. There's no way of talking about anything you love without sounding a bit like a born-again Christian.
Yeah, it's very true.
Because it's so important to me, and I wish to convey this to everyone in a way that feels not preachy, but also that does, in fact, impress on everyone that it's the greatest thing ever.
Yeah. And like I remember, and I think you actually include this in the foreword of this book, where we were, one of our first conversations about poetry, and at the time I was in a band, so I was writing a lot of songs, and I was just saying to you, I was like, it's just songs without music, and you were like, exactly, and I was like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's in the afterword. Yeah, and it was such a total, it's like, it's songs, Caroline. Yeah, you don't need the music.
We were like talking past each other. I was like, you need the music, and you were like, you don't even need the music. It's and I think what I really want to do today, when we talk about some of our favourite poems in this collection, because I don't want to talk around poetry too much, let's just like get into the fucking poems, you know?
Oh yeah,
perfect. There's too much talking around poems in general, I think. But
I nodded, you can't see that on the podcast. But I forgot that.
But this bitch nods.
This bitch nods. I'm nodding right now.
I would love for people to talk about poems, and particularly the poems like the ones in this book, the way they talk about songs that they've heard on the radio, and they want to know if the other person has heard it. It's like, you know, the one, and the chorus is like, da 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 da, and then the bridge is like, da da, and like, you know, they should talk about it that way.
Yes,
you know?
And I think for me, this was part of the reason why it was so important to me that you personally should like poetry.
Yeah.
And Tash, your friend of mine, Tash Hodgson, my flatmate, it was very important to me that Tash should also understand poetry, and in fact that everyone I hang out with should understand poetry, so that I could be like, oh my God, there is a really great one, and you will love it, and it has a really good joke about teeth in the middle.
right? And jokes, right? Just jokes and, you know, we actually were talking about this yesterday, and like, what a poem, what it really is just an extended private joke, isn't it?
A poem is an extended private joke.
Yeah.
Taken too far. Always taken too far.
Always taken too far.
There's a really great Hera Lindsey Bird line, which I'm about to mangle because I haven't got a copy of the book here, but it's something like, if there is a point when how far becomes too far, I am always beyond it.
Oh, that's and very good.
I love that line. I've mangled it. Look it up. It's in her book, Hera Lindsey Bird by Hera Lindsey Bird, which is a great title.
Which, Hera Lindsey Bird by Hera Lindsey Bird. Again, someone who had never independently bought a collection of poetry before, I have bought 3 copies of that book and given 2 away. You know, that's how...
It's that kind of book.
That's, you know, it's one of those things, yeah.
I'm just thinking about it now. Just thinking about it.
It's over there in the bookshelf. You've actually included one of her books, her poems, here.
I have. It was a real struggle. So I had this rule that I could only include 1 poem by a poet.
Yeah.
I broke it once for a poet called Emily Berry.
Who we're about to read in a minute.
Who we're about to read in a minute. Fantastic. Yeah. Because she is so funny. And because one poem had to go in for kind of thematic reasons, which is a poem called Bad New Government, and one poem is the poem of my true heart. And when I read it, I feel like I am being personally attacked for all of my worst and most lovable characteristics.
And this is why we're going to start the podcast. Our first poem of this podcast.
Thank you.
Is
I love
going
to be
this one. Yes.
Our Love Could Spoil Dinner by Emily Berry. We always breakfast with the biographer. On day 1, I showed him my grapefruit spoon. It has a serrated edge. My father gave him a Mont Blanc fountain pen as a welcome gift, but I think he was more impressed by the spoon. It's almost like a knife, he said. The biographer is a coffee nut, and I use this fact to bond with him. Oh, Robusta, I say dramatically when I know he's listening. You inferior bean. When we pass in the hall, I fling my arm back and say things like, am I strung out or what? And time for another caffeine fix, methinks. I am not allowed coffee because of my nerves, but the biographer does not know this. Sometimes we sit up in bed comparing moans. Mine are always the loudest. The biographers are hampered by his boarding school education and the British flair for embarrassment. Sometimes the publishers call. When he gets on the phone, he sweats. Afterwards, the right side of his face is damp. I like to monitor these subtle changes. Last night my father found us touching legs. Go to your room, he shouted. You shabby daughter. You worthless excuse for a story, the biographer added. They played cards to settle a debt. That day my mouth felt wetter than usual. I asked the biographer to check. He used his tongue. This may affect the results, he said.
It's so good. Okay, so what I love about this one is that it's sort of, to me, this takes place in a sort of like adolescent fantasy world. That's sort of like half Shirley Jackson, half the Royal Tenenbaums kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, totally.
And it's like, even in your own magnificent melodramatic fantasy, you're still a failure. Do you know what I mean? You're still hopelessly yourself. It's like, you know, when you when women have to sort of imagine their husbands are dead in order to masturbate. Do you know what I mean?
No, is that a thing?
It's so a thing.
Wow. Okay, we're gonna get into that off air. Yeah, but that's the thing, isn't it? It's like that saying about like wherever you go, you take yourself with you. And
yeah.
It's like I use poetry so much in escape, and so much of Emily Berry's is this like weird escapey thing for me.
Yeah.
I find so much escape in Emily Berry's poems. There's the sea and she has characters who do stuff. You need a lot. We're not going to get deep into Emily Berry here. Mm-hmm. But she has characters who do stuff. It's really interesting. This one, I fall in and I'm so embarrassed for myself.
Oh, so embarrassed for myself. Because it's so...
Speak!
It's that thing of having sex for the first time as a late teenager, like 16, 17, 18 or whatever, and sort of falling in love with the vision of yourself as someone's lover, but still owning a school uniform, you know?
Yeah, and I think like an actual school uniform rather than like a sexy school uniform.
No, as in lumpy jumper, horrible skirt.
And having to wear it and having to, like, people be like, is that nail varnish?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just me. I just love this poem because I love to feel personally attacked. And so my flatmate we were talking about earlier quite frequently says to me, am I strung out or what? When she thinks I'm being particularly bad at this poem. I mean,
yeah,
it's just such a good story. I feel this fantasy so perfectly. I want to live in it.
Yeah.
But also, it's that thing we were just saying about how even in the fantasy, it's like...
You're still a nerd in the fantasy.
I'm still, you know, you can, not allowed
coffee. You can create this like wonderful world where like a biographer comes to your house or whatever, and it's all so kind of gothic and dramatic, but you're still you.
You shabby daughter.
You shabby daughter. So who do you think the biographer is? In terms of like, who's he there to see? Because the first time I read it, I thought it was her biographer. And then no, I thought it was her father's biographer.
And then, I think he's there to see the father. Like, in my head.
In my head.
He's the father's biography. It's she's the ward, you know? Like, obviously she's the daughter, but like, she's the only daughter of the house. I mean, this is getting real deep into my psyche here.
Which is imagining people as the ward of a house.
I'm always imagining myself as the ward of a house.
Sure.
That's just...
It's an important place to... Yeah, the, you know, the ward who like, two summers ago she was but a cultish thing and now she's matured into a voluptuous beauty.
I feel like I'm everyone
sees themselves this way, you know what I mean? Everyone, again, I read writers recently and everyone wants to have that Fenella Maxwell fantasy of like, oh, she'll be a beauty in a year's time, but now she's just like knobbly knees, and then you just come through a fucking velvet curtain, you're like, it's a me, Fenella.
That's it, but I think this is just before that.
Just before that.
Just before that. But also, I'm not allowed coffee because of my nerves, but the biographer doesn't know this. He knows. Everyone knows. You talk about it all the time, Ella. I mean, obviously, this is not a poem about me, but it is a poem about me. I feel about this poem the way I felt when I was a teenager and I would like hear an album and I'd be like, this was written for me.
Yeah.
And I would know in my brain.
Yeah.
Probably it wasn't. But I'd be like, how could they know such beautiful, specific things about my own tender heart, which is the most original heart in the world? I feel about this poem the way you feel about someone famous. Like, you're someone famous you have a crush on when you're 14. And yes. You're like, he's going to marry me. I don't know how it's going to happen. But
I know this to be true. I know it with such great certainty.
I know that I could take certain steps.
Yeah.
To be married to this famous musician.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also that thing of like, not even fantasizing about... It's a bit like that same thing that goes into fancying the ugliest boy band member. Do you know what I mean?
Yes!
You know how they always say how Ringo got the most fan mail because everyone thought he was the most gettable kind of thing?
Oh my god, apparently. That's devastating. That, perfect. I
know, right?
And that's how I felt, though.
But fancying the biographer and not the rock star. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes, it's, yes, totally.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's so good. And I think it's that thing of... I can do this. I can have sex with a biographer. I can have sex.
Right. And also, there's so much... It's weird because I know that both you and I are imagining the same setting, the same sort of big English house kind of thing, kind of rolling gardens, sort of brother of the more famous Jack type of falling down. That's what I'm imagining with like lots of wings and a guest wing and stuff.
I think mine's grander than brother of the more famous Jack.
Okay, but we're still imagining a similar thing. And yet nowhere does any of this get stated. It's just inferred by things like serrated grapefruit spoon.
Right, you so know? This is...
There's so much space.
In this book... You know? In this book that I have written, or not written, you know, I've
composed.
What a great word. In this book that I have composed, I have put in a bunch of footnotes and like small scrawlings in the margin. And they're not all addressed to Caroline, but in my head, most of them are addressed to Caroline on the basis.
Well, you always say this about whenever you start writing a book, that you always address it to a very specific person. And
yes,
everything
yes,
is
I
to
do.
That person, which is a very interesting method of directing your work.
I think it's just down to being quite talkative.
Yeah.
I really write books because nobody could cope with me talking.
No, exactly. Talk. Yeah.
And therefore, if I just address a book to someone, that's 80,000 words.
That makes a lot of
sense.
And
then I don't have to get a proper job.
As someone who has talked at by you a lot, it makes a lot of sense.
It goes both ways, Caroline. Goes bloody both ways.
It does go bloody both ways.
Anyway, the footnote for this one is about the fact that I have a rich imagination around this poem.
Yeah.
And none of it's in the text.
Yes!
You just fill it in. Mine has like that, those checkerboard marble floors.
Yeah.
And I can feel like the banister. And then when I was writing
like
about
a stuffed bear covered in mothballs kind of thing.
Well, but when I was going to write about this poem, I was like happily typing away my little note about this poem about the heavy banisters. Mm-hmm. And like the way she puts her arm on the banister and like twirls around it.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Just doesn't happen. I just filled in. It's one of those real like a false memory, but for a poem. I feel like I know this poem. This is like a small snapshot of an elaborate dream world that I know very well.
Yeah.
But I can't justify that at all. I can't justify any of my feelings about this poem.
Oh, it's so bloody good.
It's just so fun as well.
Like, nothing this good should be this fun. Do you know what I mean? It's like candy floss that's good for you, you know?
You shabby daughter.
You shabby daughter!
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Next one I'm going to do is, which we've already mentioned, Monica by Hira Lindsey Bird.
How much of it are you going to read?
Well, it's a long one, so I'm just going to stop when it feels natural, basically.
It's 8 pages, this one, so...
We're not going to do that.
No, no one needs that.
All right, Monica by Hira Lindsey Bird. Monica, 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 Monica. Monica Geller of popular sitcom Friends is one of the worst characters in the history of television. She makes me want to wash my hands with hand sanitizer. She makes me want to stand in an abandoned Ukrainian parking lot and scream her name at a bunch of dead crows. Nobody liked her, except for Chandler. He married her. And that brings me to my second point. What kind of name for a show was Friends when two of them were related and the rest of them just fucked for 10 seasons? Maybe their fucking was secondary to their friendship, or they all had enough emotional equilibrium to be able to maintain a constant state of mutual respect despite the fucking or conspicuous non-fucking that was occurring in their lives. But I have to say, it doesn't seem emotionally realistic, especially considering that they were not the most self-aware of people, and to be able to maintain a friendship through the various complications of heterosexual monogamy is enormously difficult, especially when you take into consideration what cunts they all were. I fell in love with a friend once, and we liked to congratulate each other over what good friends we were and how it was great that we could be such good friends and still fuck until we stopped fucking and then we weren't such good friends anymore. I had a dream the other night about this friend and how we were walking through sunlight many years ago, dragged up from the vaults like old military propaganda. You know the kind, young women leaving a factory arm in arm while their fiancés are being handsomely shot to death in Prague. And even though this friend doesn't love me anymore, and I don't love them, at least not in a romantic sense, the memory of what it had been like to not want to strap concrete blocks to my head and drown myself in a public fountain rather than spend another day with them not talking to me came back, and I remembered the world for a moment as it had been when we had just met and love seemed possible. I'm going to stop there because it's such a long poem.
But I think that gives you
a sense of what the poem is, which is, you know, it's a poem about friends. But it's also...
a poem about falling in love.
It's a poem about...
I mean, it really is 8 pages. It's 8 pages of...
with very detailed notes about Friends. It's not just like, oh, she's... it's not as if she's like, oh, she's going to use Monica Geller as like this opening conceit and then she's going to go off into this thing about military propaganda. She comes back to Friends a lot. She talks about specifics, particularly about Monica Geller's parents who weren't very nice to her.
I mean... I'm just going to read another bit of it because it's really good. Often I look at the world and I am dumbfounded that anyone can function at all, given the kind of violence that so many people have inherited from the past. But that's still no excuse to throw a dinner plate at your friends during a quiet game of Pictionary. And even if that was an isolated incident and she was able to move on from it, it still doesn't make me want to watch her on TV. I am falling in love and I don't know what to do about it. Throw me in a haunted wheelbarrow and set me on fire. And don't even get me started on Ross. Oh, it's so great. I mean, I named the book after it. You can see that from the way it's called Set Me On Fire. And this is Throw Me In A Haunted Wheelbarrow And Set Me On Fire. A perfect sentence.
A perfect, perfect sentence.
Throw me in a haunted wheelbarrow and set me on fire. That's exactly what it's like falling in love with someone. That's exactly what it's like meeting someone. I hate it.
It's so interesting, the two poems we've chosen, because it's like, the Emily Berry one is like, playing at love and playing at the melodrama of love when you haven't earned that melodrama yet. Whereas Monica is about that sort of like, oh God, I'm 33 and I'm falling in love again and I know exactly how this goes and exactly how it ends.
It's just that I believe it's that, although I believe there are ways that love could endure, it's just that statistically or based on personal experience, it is unlikely that things are going to go well for long. It kills me! This poem, this fucking poem!
It murders me.
It's everything. It's that thing of, if I just don't talk about what I am feeling here, I will manage to shut up about this for 30 fucking seconds and therefore it will go away. If we just don't talk about these feelings.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Another poem that I feel constantly personally skewered by. But it's just so... And I... It is very easy, I think, for want of a better word, I want to kind of call the poetry establishment to be like, yeah, it's a poem about Friends. Friends is a stupid American TV show. Mm-hmm. And to mix high and low culture in this way is really disgraceful. Not that I've ever heard anyone say that, but that's what I imagine.
No, but there is a snittishness to talking about pop culture in high art, I think. And poetry is supposed to be the reserve of, it's the winner's circle of art, right? You know?
Yes. It's high art. It's meant to be, and I think that's part of my deep problem with a lot of poetry, is it's meant to be high art. It's meant to be something... rarefied, I guess. Mm. Whereas for me, poetry is very small and happens all the time. I am, this is a bit of a tangent, but obsessed with, e.g., See It, Say It, Sorted, because I'm like, it's a poem! It's a poem that happens every day! And they decided that it had to be a poem to make people listen.
Mm.
And there's poetry in Friends and there's poetry in everything, because poetry is just people. Poetry is just a good joke. And this is a very good joke. This poem is...
And it's so unbelievably skillful, the way it goes from, like, talking about Friends, a thing that we all know, to, like, going into this, like, repeated, very jarring Soviet imagery that she keeps coming back to. Like, even the, like, you know, strapping cement blocks to my head and drowning me in a fountain kind of thing, and handsomely shot to death in Prague, and, like...
It's screaming like, your name at a field of crows. Ukrainian parking lot.
It keeps coming back to this very grey Soviet bloc thing, and it's so interesting, and it doesn't... Because it's, like, it's got this thing where it's, like, it's taking the sort of, like, the shiny colourfulness of American sitcom, and we're also familiar with the kind of... And what love should look like and what friendship should look like and then the austere reality of what it is, you know?
It's just horrible.
It's just horrible.
But also, I love that it takes Friends seriously. This is not a poem that's like, Friends, a television show we all used to watch. Mm-hmm. It's like, Friends, a thing that I care about passionately. I am yelling at my Uber driver, a man who does not know what the characters of Friends are. She asks him and he says, you should read the whole poem because I'm going to reference it.
Mm-hmm.
It's on page 90 of my new book, available in all good bookstores. and on the internet, I should say, for people who are listening to podcasts and are probably not in Waterstones right now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I asked him what character he liked best of Friends, he said, the woman. The Uber driver does not care.
He doesn't know how to talk about Friends, meaning she brought Friends up.
Right? She starts this poem.
She's in an Uber. Just starting a conversation about Friends.
I mean, talking to an Uber driver is a very lonely thing to do. Yeah. I do it a lot.
Yeah, you can talk to an Uber driver for
anything. Not about Friends.
No, you don't just bring up a long dead sitcom unless you're truly bothered by it.
Unless you're truly bothered by the idea of having 22 minutes in a cab alone thinking about how you might be in love with someone.
Yeah.
That is when you're like, what do you think your favourite character from Friends is, driver? Is it there are more than one woman. You're not taking this game seriously. Could you take this more seriously, please? Because if you don't, I will have to be quiet, and then I will have to think about
the house I just left, or I'm just going to.
I'm falling in love and I don't know what to do about it. No one knows what to do about it. That's what's so awful. Oh no. Will I text them? Will they text me back? Probably not. Will I die? Probably. I mean, definitely. At some point. But, oh my God, it's ghastly. Oh my God.
And that thing of like, I used to have a friend. We used to congratulate ourselves for what good friends we were until we stopped fucking and then we weren't such good friends. It's like, oh, everyone's early 20s. Like, pretty much everyone's early 20s.
Devastating, really.
It's devastating. And what do you think of the... Like, what makes this a poem and not a blog post?
Ooh, what an interesting question.
Yeah. Because I remember this got quite, internet famous in a way, because it was often reposted on famous American blogs like The Toast. Not The Toast, but things like The Toast or The Hairpin or whatever. That was like, you know... Funny American women being sort of arch about their relationships. What makes this a poem and not a blog?
So, Emily Dickinson? No. Yeah, Emily Dickinson.
The Dead Lonely Lady.
Emily Dickinson. Inside girl, Emily Dickinson. Famous inside girl, Emily
Indoors
Dickinson.
Chick.
Indoors chick, Emily
Back
Dickinson.
Backgammon lover.
I think it was her. If not, Emily Dickinson, I think, famously said she knew something was a poem if when she read it she felt cold all over and like the top of her head had come off.
Yeah.
And I think it's a bit like that very famous definition of pornography, is that you know it when you see it.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, if you don't think this is a poem, I am very sorry for you, because it's a fantastic poem. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm not going to be able to convince you. Is it just that it's got line breaks?
That's
part of it. But also, it's a poem because when I read it, it makes me feel cold and a bit sick and I just want to lie on the ground thinking about being in love or not being in love. Yeah. And also, Monica Geller.
It's that mixture of, like, feeling so full and fed and like, oh, this is so, it's like a good stew, but also, like, I feel barren and empty and, like, the stew is going to go through a hole in my back. You know?
Ah, poetry.
Ah, poetry.
Yes, I think that's it. Is that a lot of people think things are poems that aren't, I don't think, are poems.
Such as?
I'm not going to name them because they're poets who do good stuff. I think a lot of things I have seen in poetry anthologies and in the poetry world, I'm like, this is not a poem for me. I read it and I feel nothing. Mm-hmm. These are just some words arranged into sentences.
Mm-hmm.
This I read and I feel very ill and sad and also full, but the stew has gone through the hole in my back. I will never truly be
warm
again.
Why can't you talk about this? It's impossible to talk about poems without coming up with insane things to say, because it's so hard to describe how it makes you feel.
I think for me, the reason we're using quite so many metaphors, and the reason I always use a lot of mixed metaphors. Mm-hmm. I really find it very difficult to speak
Our life is just composing mixed metaphors together.
But the best game. A thing is like another thing.
A thing is like another thing.
Similes! But one of the reasons I like to talk about poetry in a way that feels like the way I talk about anything else,
mm-hmm.
i.e. making up very stupid metaphors or trying to think of, it is like when the stew goes through a hole in your back. It's a dumb metaphor and we shouldn't have come up with it. It's bad. But I want poetry to feel part of the everyday in a way that I think historically it hasn't.
Mm.
I want it to feel like it belongs in my life, and I do feel like it belongs in my life in the same way as any other experience.
Yeah.
Any, you know, cooking or walking or talking to people or going for a drink or kissing someone. It feels like it belongs in those categories, right?
Yeah.
And so to talk about it in a way that is more rarefied, I guess, frightens me a bit, because I think you're getting closer and closer to a kind of academic take on poetry, which
is a form of ring fencing, kind of.
Yeah, and I'm sure it has worth for some people.
Yeah.
It has no worth for me, personally. Picking apart a poem, except in this way, where we sit at your kitchen table and go, oh my god, and just at the bit where she says, Phoebe gave birth to her brother's triplets, it's so sassy, but also, like, Phoebe is everyone's favourite, but also Monica. Monica Geller.
And I was also hate that thing where you hating the characters that you know are the most like yourself thing that everyone can relate to as well. And
oh my god, yes.
Just so
I mean,
very good.
That's why I hate Monica. That isn't why I hate Monica. I don't hate Monica. I don't hate anyone except myself. In terms of falling in love, you know.
And different shades of myself I see reflected in other people. Oh, God. I could talk about this all day, which is why we're going to move on to Mr. Darcy by Victoria Chang. Which, this is one of the poems where most of these poems, when I was flicking through this book, I was like, oh, it was kind of like a scrapbook of the last 8 years together. Of like, oh, I remember where I was when Ella showed me this kind of thing.
One of my main criteria for picking poems for this book was, how do I think Caroline would feel about it?
Aww.
I know, but it was very useful to have you in mind as a kind of test reader, essentially. And if I thought a poem was more difficult or less likely to be, not more difficult exactly, but more tricky, more something that you would be like, Ella, I've only got 10 minutes, I have many things to do, this is boring and I am bored. Which
hit me.
Hit you, yeah. Just like, I don't get it and I'm not gonna.
I don't care. Which is why there's a minimum of poems about nature in this, which I appreciated.
You get very bored about nature.
I fucking hate talking about nature.
I love talking about nature.
Which is a real shame because I'm best friends with Nature Girl who just wants to stop all the time to look at a fucking thrush.
This is a super old fight. We have this fight nearly every day every day. Go for a walk. I say, Caroline, look at this blade of grass. I think it's very interesting. And she says, fuck off. Not a blade of grass. Usually it's like a good bird or
yes,
a view.
Yes, good bird. And I'm just like, oh, you're just doing a thing. You're just trying to be like top girl, like finding a five-pointed leaf. Like, miss. I'm like, fuck off, you little nature brown noser. I don't know why I assign so much hatred to this trait. But truly, I love it. But anyway, this poem was actually one you hadn't shown me before, and I was like, oh, this is exciting. And then I looked at the footnote, and the footnote was literally like, this poem is so much more fun when you read it out loud. And I read it out loud in the safety of my bedroom, and then I just like laughed and read it again, and it was the nicest experience.
This makes me very happy. This is exactly why I put these footnotes in.
Yeah.
Right, because for better or for worse, I have absorbed quite a lot of knowledge about poetry and how to read poetry and what poems are supposed to feel like. And not everyone has that, because most people had a life where they went outside instead of just being a small loser reading poetry on the internet for years.
So?
I go outside sometimes now. Mr. Darcy by Victoria Chang. In the end, she just wanted the house and a horse, not much more. What if he didn't own the house, or worse, not even a horse? How do we separate the things from a man, the man from the things? Is a man still the same without his reins? Here it rains every 15 minutes. It would be foolish to marry a man without an umbrella. Did Cinderella really love the prince, or just the prince on the curtains in the ballroom? Once I went window shopping, but I didn't want a window. When do you know it's time to get a new man, one who can win more things at the fair? I already have 4 stuffed pandas from the fair. I won fair and square. Is it time to be less square, to wear something more revealing in north and south? She does the dealing, gives him the money in the end, but she falls in love with him when he has the money, when he is still running away. If the water is running in the other room, is it wrong for me to not want to chase it because it owns nothing else? When I wave to a man I love, what happens when another man with a lot more bags waves back?
Oh, I love this one so much because it feels like, what if rap, but also Jane Austen? Like, it feels like a lyric sheet for a rap, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it's just like that constant, like, sort of twisting on the word all the time, from reins to reins, and, you know.
Because just... when you texted me about this to say you'd read it for the first time, and you said, it feels like Jay-Z.
It does feel, it feels like old school Jay-Z, like, you know?
And I loved getting a load of texts from you about this poem. People are really getting an insight into our texting life, which is I loved getting texts from you about a poem because I felt like it was a really good test case for this book, was this poem that you had not read before, where I had put like a very small bit of guidance at the bottom, like, read it out, you'll like it more.
Yeah.
And then you were saying all these things that I had never thought of, like, it's Jay-Z meets Jane Austen, it's like this Jay-Z track, you should listen to this.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I find it very fun. I find it very fun to be that free with language, to be, meanings are flexible, you know?
Yeah.
What things sound the same?
Yeah, and it feels like, it feels like a parlor game or something, you know?
Which is so interesting, given that it's this kind of Austen-y world of take a word and spin it and give it to the next person.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's like, and it, but it's also kind of oddly cynical, you know? It's sort of like joyous and bouncy, but it's also like this, it's like a kind of a carousel spinning round and around of like, okay, we like acquiring men and then binning them and acquiring them and binning them. And like, what can we get from people? And like basically tearing down or exposing really what those Jane Austen books were, which is just like, how can we survive financially by just pinning ourselves to men over and over again?
Yes, you know? I think a carousel is a really good image for this. And it's not what I thought of, but now I can kind of, they match up really neatly, right? Like, round and round the horses go, and you're trying to get the horses and winning things at the fair.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got these four stuffed pandas from the fair, I won fair and square. It's fun, but it's the only way to have fun. It's the only game in town. I think it's very rare to find a small bit of art that holds up a kind of mirror to something you already know and bounces it back in a new light. Yeah. I feel differently about Pride and Prejudice having read this poem. I think it pulls out things that were kind of not necessarily hidden to me. I think I was aware of the kind of cynicism and the funniness. You know, people are always talking about Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
They are.
They are. It's like, it's the most, that's amazing, the skill of the poem. It's the most talked to death subject in town. And yet the fact that I can still see new shadows cast on the wall as this poem shines on it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating. Like the idea of being able to shine new light on, the idea of being able to shine new light on Jane Austen at this point.
I know, come on.
Come on, we've all talked about it. If you've read it, you've read it. If you haven't, you're not going to.
It would be foolish to marry a man without an umbrella. Cinderella really loved the prince, or just the prince on the curtain in the ballroom once I went window shopping, but I didn't want a window. It's kind of, it's sort of ridiculous. And actually, it's funny because there's a lot of internal rhyme, but no, like, what's the opposite of an internal rhyme, you know?
I don't know the word for it. This was a really interesting thing about writing the footnotes of this book, is realising quite how much me not ever really paying attention in an English lesson.
Yeah.
Not quite damaged me, but I don't know the words for stuff.
Same. I often find this, but people often think with writers that we care much more about grammar than we do. Right? And like literary terms for things. And like, people often say to me that like, oh God, sorry, my grammar is all over the place if they're showing me a piece of their writing or whatever. Like, oh, I'm not a writer. And it's like, I said, what the fuck do you mean? Knowing the difference between the three different theirs, that's pretty important. But like, the difference between less than or fewer, I'm like, whatever sounds nice in the sentence in that paragraph.
That's it. I think I'm more of a pedant than you in that I know, I think probably I have cared more about grammar rules.
Yeah.
Throughout my life. But I still don't care in a piece of writing. I care about the sound of it before. I care about the sound and I care about the sentence. Mm-hmm. Much more than I care about the actual,
the correctness.
The correctness. Things. I mean, I think people get bogged down when they're talking about poetry in the correctness. Mm. I remember you saying really early on that you didn't know how to read a poem and that you didn't know how to get the secret meaning. Do you remember that conversation?
Yeah, I do.
You were talking about how you felt like poetry was written in a secret language and that you had to decode it. And I was like, no, you don't. You just take it exactly as it comes.
But that's how it's presented, though.
It is. It's presented at school. And I remember, I've just had this vivid memory. We all had to have these anthologies at school.
Yeah.
And, like, underlining bits very carefully in, like, different colours of fine liner or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just being like, this means this.
I remember in the poetry anthology in ours, it'd be like, let's say it's a Seamus Heaney poem or whatever. And it'll be like, underline a river. Like, this refers to the river near Seamus Heaney's house that, like, on one side of it, Protestants lived and the other side, Catholics lived or whatever. And you'd be like, well, how the fuck was I meant to know that? I'm 10. You know what I mean?
Like, totally. Totally. I find it, like, not to keep bringing it back to Hero Lindsay Bird, but there's an amazing line in one of her poems I particularly love about, I want to take you to the river that runs behind my house, but there is no river behind my house. Oh, I
love that one. Yeah.
And I think maybe that's why, for me, that Hero Lindsay Bird book felt so refreshing and important. And one of the reasons I give it to people who I think might be, like, on the tipping point of getting big into poems.
Yeah.
Because it's so, to quote her again, once upon a time I felt a little bit like, huh. And then I felt a little more like, uh-huh.
Literally written down in one of her poems. It's so good.
Yeah, there's a lot of ellipses in there that I couldn't convey with my voice, but
yeah.
I think also that's something really fun about these poems. So I tried really hard in this book to choose written poems rather than performance poems transcribed, because I'm not very good at performance poetry. I'm not very good at like picking it apart, the nuance. For me, it feels more like music, and I like music. I like it fine, guys, but I don't understand it. And I didn't feel at all confident in saying, this is how the poem is performed. For example, someone like Holly McNish, who I can totally appreciate what she's doing, but I don't know how or why. I don't know how it comes together. So the poetry I love, the modern poetry I love particularly, and in fact, in this collection, the poems from, for want of a better word, the past. For me, they're very textual poems. Like, this poem actually feels more read out loud than quite a lot of the other ones in this collection. I don't know, I was just thinking about punctuation. And
yeah, the Mr. Darcy one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am very bad at, as I say, at performance poetry, and I find hearing poetry read aloud, except when it's by people I already really trust.
Did you find that a struggle? Because obviously there's a, in some, like, it's in some cultures, like, spoken word poetry is much bigger than others, so you have to, like, that must have been difficult.
It was really hard. It was just, I mean, I think, without wanting to get too far into the kind of huge diversity thing that was a real driving force behind this book, so without wanting to kind of get into it, as probably everyone who's been anywhere near me for the last month knows, there is a huge problem with diversity in anthologies. You know, you can turn over 40 pages before you find a woman. You could turn over 90 pages before you find a person who isn't white. It is, it's genuinely staggering. I was looking at one the other day, and there were maybe four poets who weren't white in it.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And this came out in the 2000s. Like, this is not an old...
Do you think that has a lot to do with first of all, lack of originality, and second of all, cheapness? Because lots of poems that are in the public... what's the word for it? Public domain?
Are free. Are for, and by white men.
The dead whites. The precious dead whites.
I think that's exactly why. And I think as an anthology compiler...
And third of all, straight racism.
Straight racism. And so I think the problem is kind of... that as an anthology compiler, you're really working with what you've got, and that tends to be poems in other anthologies. So it's a self-perpetuating cycle,
right,
in that there are so many poems by white men, and then there are a reasonable amount of poems by white women, and then quite a lot below.
Yeah.
There start to be poems by people who aren't white.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I think poetry is having such a moment it is now, because, I mean, it's quite boring to talk about, but we talk about so much about how social media and the internet has ruined so many things, but the one thing that it seems to be really causing a kind of a renaissance is the wrong word, because these poets have always been there, but they're coming to the top easier now because they're being retweeted and blogged about, and
it gives people a voice, and there's some there are so many unbelievable poets in this collection I would never have come across without the internet. So one of the things I did was read a lot of Tumblrs, which sounds ridiculous, but it felt like the only way to break that cycle of I'm in the poetry library and I'm surrounded by dead white men and some living white women.
Every time you go to the poetry library, you come back borderline on the verge of a nervous breakdown, because you're like, how am I going to fix poetry?
How am I going to fix it all, guys? And one thing I did have to try and keep in mind, and I'm still trying to keep in mind at the time of recording, this book is out tomorrow morning, and I am extremely trying to keep in mind the fact that I'm not expected to fix the whole problem all at once. And in fact, I can't.
Just on your corner of the puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't even really my place to fix it all at once. But what I can do, and what I want to do with this anthology, is to get more diverse voices, younger and more exciting voices, into places where they might otherwise have just bought an anthology that was mostly full of Yeats and Auden and Please Don't.
And sort of just had it on the coffee table and occasionally looked at it and gone like, not for me, you know?
Yeah. I want this to feel like being on fire. I want it to feel like you can't get warm. I want it to feel like the top of your head's come off. I want it to feel like the stew is coming through your back.
Very proud of that one. All right. Last poem of the day. I'm actually really proud of this, because Franny Choi was somebody I knew about before I met you. Which is like the one living poet I knew about before I met you.
Was she?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I had seen her for some reason. I was going through that phase everyone goes through in their early 20s of listening to a lot of TED Talks and thinking that would be the answer. And she had done some kind of TEDx. She had done a performance of her poem, Pop Goes Korea, and I loved it, and I went into a whole thing with her, and then I kind of forgot about her, and then I met you and we started talking about her again. But this book, this one is called Solitude by Franny Choi. I hope no one comes to my party, I said out loud, and meant it. In the email, I tried to sound too busy to care. Like, I'm having too much sex to waste time on proper punctuation, pretending it's not the other way around. Laura convinced me to jump into the Narragansett Bay on my birthday, February. There's no good word for the opposite of fire, the ice's sear and split, how it beckons the blood toward what means to end it. Oh God, I gasped over and over as we stumbled through the snow back to the car, me and my burning legs. Now that's my kind of intimacy. Faceless, salty. No wondering how my jokes are going over, just running straight toward warmth as my skin bursts open in shock. I think that might be my favourite poem of all time.
It's perfect.
It's so perfect.
I've said that a lot this podcast. But that's it. Oh, that's the feeling.
Love it.
That's the feeling of being alive, is your skin bursting open in shock. And if you don't feel like that, read more poems.
Just the way it begins with... I feel very skewered by this. Like, if Emily Berry is you, then Franny Choi is me. That thing like, I don't know, like having too much sex to waste time on proper punctuation, pretending it's not the other way around. Like, I am that gal who says something flip at a party that she practiced on the way over there, you know? And then it just like ends in this, it's such a short poem, but it ends in this place of just like, oh God, I'm just like an animal who's like feral and I just want to be this way forever, you know? Ugh.
I love you.
I love you for making me know this poem.
I think this is your poem in terms of... I think what's interesting about this poem, and one reason it makes me think this is you when I read it, is that thing of having to be convinced that you want to be in the icy water up to your eyes burning. Because she starts off like, it's quite a domestic thing. Like, I'm in an email, my party, nice, nice, nice. Yeah. And it's like, but there is like a weird urge in you that can be compelled.
Yeah.
I am now in the ice. My skin
is burning. I literally go
open.
Swimming in the Atlantic in February. I have done that.
But,
you know, it's like, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I feel like, but there's like a thing in you that just like needs, like for me, you always seem a little bit split between like, but I've made it so nice. I'm writing an email. I'm having a party. I'm having sex and I care about punctuation. But secretly your heart is like, should we do it? Should we jump into the ice?
Yeah, should we just throw this vase out the car window? Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think this is one of the other things about poetry, and I don't know if Caroline's going to cut this. She might, because I was just revealing about her secret personality, and she might hate that. But a thing about poetry is that you can hold it up to your people and be like, look at you.
Look at you. Ha. It's like a meme. It's like a picture of a cat having a bad day and sending it to your friend and being like, it's you.
I send so many people poems. I think some of them think I am weird because I send them poems like, haha, it you. But I know my true friends because they reply with, yes.
Or, oh my God.
Oh no.
Oh no.
One of my favourite experiences of poetry was sending a friend a poem by Heather Crystal without context or title and the friend thinking that I had written it about them. It was extremely good. I felt very like, I have matched.
Oh,
the
very
matchmaking
good.
Has come.
Very, very good.
Did Ella write this? No, it's nope. Heather Crystal, a genius.
Well, that just proves that you are extremely good at picking poems, and all the best ones in the world are in this book.
All the best ones in the world I could afford. There are some poems.
There are limitations on everything.
I mean, this was a really interesting thing about making this anthology, was... really good poems are expensive, which I guess makes sense. You wouldn't expect the best art of anything else in the world to come reasonably cheaply, but I kind of did with poems because as a person who has sold some poems, you don't usually get very much for them and no one really seems to value them. But I tried very hard. All the best poems that were within my price range. Some of them were very expensive and I put them in anyway because of my feelings.
I'm so glad you did.
So am I.
This book is in all good bookshops and some bad bookshops. And online.
Yeah, on the normal places. If you're boycotting Amazon, it's on Waterstones.
Hooray.
I don't know if it's out in America because I don't know the rights situation. I probably should. please buy it, because it was really hard to do and I'm really proud of it. And I feel a bit sick when I look at it, which, as discussed, is the point of poetry.
I mean, yeah, for, like, you have... I mean, I've watched you compose this book for a long time now. And for a book that, like, you've written maybe 15% of the words in, you have worked very, very, very hard on. It is a huge feat getting an anthology together. I just thought it was, like, Googling a few bits and putting them together. But no.
No, it was a lot of lying on the kitchen floor surrounded by papers. That day we went to see Pokemon, the Pikachu Detective Pikachu, I had spent something like 7 hours lying flat on the kitchen floor, just going, this will never work. There will never be a book. I understand that it's too late for me to back out because I have taken their money and signed their contract. But I can't do it. And I did do it! Amazing!
So everyone here, go buy it now.
Go buy it. Okay, I think we have to stop now.
We have to stop now. Thank you.
Grab some tea now.
Yes.
Bye.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me by the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.